part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Let's begin our chat. Let's just start by saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I have two very special guests on the line. I have Drew Zucker and Philip Seavey on the line. I got Seavey correct, right?
You did. Well done.
Drew coached me. I said Seavey before. Drew coached me earlier on. But you are both the creators of this book, coming out through Dark Horse Comics, correct?
Correct, yes.
And it is called The House. Mm-hmm. And I just finished rereading it this morning before I jumped on. I read a little bit before a couple of weeks ago when we had kind of like gone back and forth over dates for this interview. And I have to say, I mean, you know, rereading it and going over it, I mean, you have combined two of my favorite things, like haunted house stuff, horror stuff, with World War II soldier drama action stuff. So you took the chocolate and the peanut butter and you mixed it together and made a book that I think I really love.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, do you want to, for nobody who's, I mean, it seems like you've done this on Kickstarter for a while and Dark Horse may have picked it up. I don't know the full on details, but is this something that you were crowdfunding for a while as a project and was broken up into parts, or how did all of that work?
Yeah, so we first started publishing the book in the beginning of 2017. We released it as single issues via Comixology submit platform.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, it was digital only. There were 7 issues we released. It was the whole story. And then once it was done, we used Kickstarter to crowdfund a printing of the trade, the collection. Yeah. And we had that printed in early 2018. And then over the last few years, we've just been hand selling and we've sold out nearly of our entire print run. And so I reached out to Dark Horse last year, who I have a working relationship with over the years, and asked them if they would be interested in reprinting the trade for like wide distribution. And they excitedly said yes and jumped on the opportunity. And so we just worked together to put together a new edition, and it's out in stores now. And I think Amazon this week. So,
oh, that's great. No, that's great. I mean, so you were selling it like at conventions, like you said, hand selling it. I would imagine that was at cons and stuff like that.
Yeah, conventions or to retailers online, like any of our sales were done essentially through one-on-one communication with people, either websites or the like. So this will be the first time it's available to order through Diamond and Penguin Random House and all sorts of major shopping platforms.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, let me first say congratulations, because that's kind of a big deal, right? To get your book out there. And just to clarify, Philip, you are the writer and Drew, you are the artist, or did you share chores? Like how did, what's the division of labor amongst the house, I should say? The chores, who did the chores in the house?
Philip was the writer. I was the artist for it. It's really kind of a co-creation from both of us.
Sure.
The initial idea kind of started with me as a paragraph. I knew, you know, that idea of World War II soldiers in haunted house. And then when Philip and I met, I just went to him and was like, oh, I have this idea for a book. I was fresh out of college at the time, you know, and I asked him, do you write? And he went, yes, I do. Mm. So I sent him the paragraph I had, and he came back with a 12-page outline for a story.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, from there, over the years, we kind of whittled it down and worked it into what it became. And then when the time came to actually start, you know, physically producing it, it kind of had become this amalgamation of both of us working through the idea.
Sure. So Yeah, no, I mean, having read it, and I'm a big fan of horror. I mean, I don't know if you've checked out our podcast, but like every October we do like horror movies and stuff like that. We go over old horror stuff and, you know, each one of us, like my regulars that come on or guests that we've had on before, we'll like pick a horror movie. But one of my favorite horror movies of all time is the original Haunting, directed by Robert Wise, which I'm sorry.
That's a good one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I absolutely love that movie to death. And then another one is The Innocents, which I don't know if you've ever seen that. But being that those two are my some of my favorite, and they're black and white, like horror movies, very dependent on like atmosphere and stuff like that. You know, and we talked about The Haunting on one of our episodes of our podcast. And I think that my friend Paul Edwards, who comes on the show with me every once in a while, or has been for a long time, we called it sort of the like It's a Wonderful Life of like horror movies. It's like the movie that you kind of like have to watch, or at least for us, we had to watch like every year. Like you watch It's a Wonderful Life during Christmas. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I reading this and getting into it and it starting off like, oh, this is like World War. Well, there's also a chapter that opens, it seems like in Pilgrim times, I'll call it, in my ignorant. When they eventually sort of get to this house, like it's very cool how things unwind and Drew, I very much like the look of the book. There's a lot of like darks and blacks and things like that. And the whole environment is like very creepy. And you know, the way things go down, like the pacing is like very fast. It's fast paced and things happen like very quickly. And, it's a very, you know, dramatic and tension filled read. But to me, the question that I have for you guys is, and one of the things that I think one of you writes, like at the end of the book, you know, there's a school of thought that thinks you can't necessarily do horror in comics. So when you were approaching this, like, how did you go about like sort of like being able to create this sort of, you know, environment? Because sometimes with film, it's easier to do things than with comics, because in comics, you're sort of like going at your own pace as you're reading. Right. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, totally. I think this is that was a question we discussed a lot and have even to this day still discuss a lot. Like the different approaches you have to take for stories depending on the medium you're in. Like comics, you can't rely on soundtracks or jump scares or other kind of typical devices you see in horror movies because, like you pointed out, film and TV controls the pacing at which you like absorb the material, but comics, it's all dependent on the reader. So there's no way to surprise someone as effectively as like moving pictures. Obviously you can do things with page turns and whatnot. But so we've always felt that the best horror in comics is very psychological horror, where you're building to a moment and you're getting under the skin of people. I think a really good example of kind of how we accomplished it in the book is there's a sequence where the soldiers basically find their way into a room and barricade the door. And then slowly, like the window on the wall, which is casting the only light in the room, just shrinks and disappears out of existence and kind of plunges them into darkness. And then they're like flicking their lighter, trying to see what's going on. And then once they get the lighter on, they, you know, they see what else has now joined them in the room. And it's an example of like just kind of that slow build up to a moment that regardless of how fast or slow you're absorbing the material, there is kind of that controlled element of just very minute changes to an environment that kind of can facilitate that creepy feeling and that sense of dread that works best when you're doing horror comics.
Yeah. So like, as far as like the construction of pages, Drew, for you, I mean, you were both very, I mean, it was masterful to me, like how I was reading this book. And even though I have control over like how I'm going through the book, I found myself like going through it very quickly. You know what I mean? Like very much like, oh my gosh, like being pulled along, you know?
Right.
And so Drew, like for you constructing panels and pages and things like that, did you have to, like, I know that sometimes, like, when I work on my own sort of like hobby stuff, like my own hobby comics and stuff like that, I'm tending to, I don't necessarily have like the big scope of like what I'm looking at. I'm just going page by page and, you know, have like a script, obviously. But like with panel construction, you've done such a great job with this book. Were you going like looking at the script and constructing it page by page, or did you have to pull out to a macro level and plan it that way?
The house was kind of a weird one because it was also Philip and I kind of getting used to working with each other. So the original scripts early on required a lot of me going in and having to make adjustments where I needed it for myself.
Sure.
So the example that we like to use for that kind of stuff is that opening scene with the pilgrims that you called them.
Yeah.
That scene was originally 2 pages.
Okay.
And it was drawn that way. And eventually I came back to it and I told Phil, you know, I think I've got a better idea for this of how we can do this.
Yeah.
And it expanded out to the size that it is in the book. And what ended up coming out of that was the Ethan Wilde journal entry. That's the dialogue for the scene.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how this worked, was there was simultaneously a very concentrated look at every scene and what every scene was going to require, but there was also a larger picture,
sure,
all the time of what we were doing, because the comics doing horror gets tricky.
Yeah,
it's like Phil said, you can't use the music and the movement of the camera and, you know, sound and all these other things. What you can kind of do though is use jump scares, but they can't be applied in the same way that, say, a movie applies it. It's understanding how to build those panels out for every scene, to make that work. But it's also, you can't just use the trick over and over again. So that was a lot of what went into this when it came to construction, was what does the scene require? What kind of horror are we trying to do per scene? Is it that there's a monster? Is it that there's more of a feeling here? And then kind of work through that as the baseline.
Sure. 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 So, I mean, Drew, it sounds to me like we had a little bit of a conversation before we, you know, started getting into this. Drew, it sounds to me like you've been into comics for a while. Philip, were you a comic fan before you started this? Were you a comic writer? What sort of a writer were you before you jumped into the house? And then the other part of that, my curiosity on that is, as far as like creating a horror comic, was there anything that you might have used as inspiration or a template and been like, okay, this is what we need to go to sort of like construct the world that we're trying to build?
Yeah, great question. So yeah, I've been reading comics since I was a kid, and I've been wanting to work in comics since I think I was 9 years old is when I decided I was going to do that. So when Drew and I met and then started working together, he had just finished his degree at the Savannah College of Art and Design.
Oh, nice.
Which is an art school in Georgia that has the oldest degree rewarding program in sequential art. So he had just got his BFA, and I had actually just started my MFA in the same program. So we just kind of ships passed in the night. I've actually, in comics, I probably have more credits to my name as an artist than a writer.
Oh, okay.
But they're starting to balance out now. So the house was one of those projects. We started it, I mean, geez, in 2010 is when we started working on the project. So it is both one of my earliest and most recent projects, depending on the year. I had written stuff before. I had done a long form web comic before I started at SCAD. I think the house is probably one of the first like writing credits to my name as a professional. Even though it took a couple years from when we started it till it saw publication, during that time, I kind of started my career working for Top Cow and Dark Horse and other people as an artist. And then around the time with The House, I did another book called Paradox, and that transitioned into a creator-owned miniseries that I did at Dark Horse called Triage that I wrote and drew So the house kind of allowed me to pivot into a writer slash cartoonist space, but it was also one where I got to work with Drew as an artist and kind of just focus on writing. And as far as like kind of inspiration or templates I took, I think, you know, initially, and this is one of the things that I think Drew kind of plays into his mentioning of like learning how to work with each other early on.
Yeah.
I wrote the house very much more like a screenplay. And not that I had worked in film before, but that's where I had done a lot of my writing in stuff like that. So when I was handing him scripts, the earlier versions and even some of the versions that he drew from, they were structured a little bit more film-like, which he did a phenomenal job of adapting really difficult things I was asking. And this was early on, so I wasn't as quite aware until I would start to get pages back to the action I was describing was more of a fluid motion action that works better on camera versus, you know, panel type sequential work. So he would have to take, you know, things that I would write seeing in my head as a movie and translate them into static images. And I think we found a way as time went on to be like, oh, okay, this is how this works best. And this is, it taught me a lot about, how to pace out and adjust my storytelling to fit the medium of comics better. So, I mean, going into it, I was, you know, a huge fan of horror. Both of us are. I think I had just finished Mark Z. Danielewski's House of Leaves, which is one of my favorite horror books of all time. And initially, I think that influenced the house a whole lot more. And as we worked on rewrites and outlines and kind of finding what made this story unique, a lot of the influence, I think, just kind of slowly faded to like inspiration as opposed to like, ooh, how do I do, you know, an ever shifting maze inside a comic, which is just impossible to do visually. So I learned a lot, but I mean, there's plenty of horror comics that I love and I'm huge fans of. I think From Hell by Alan Moore is the greatest comic of all time.
Oh, yeah.
A very different kind of horror story than what we told, but I think horror in comics can produce some like incredible stuff. I mean, Alan Moore Swamp Thing, Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez's Lock and Key is another one that both Drew and I are huge fans of. And you just kind of go on and on about the different horror comics that just define the genre and execute it so well.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a lot like film. Horror has a lot of people that want to play in it, and only, you know, a lot of people want to play in it, and only a handful truly understand how to do it, because they've gone, you can tell the ones that have gone back and broken down bit by bit how to actually go about doing this.
Sure. Sure. Well, what about you, Drew? What were some of your, I mean, inspirations? I mean, Philip mentioned some books. Are there any other things that you like drew off of while you were drawing this book or putting it together?
So I love one of my favorite movies of all time is Alien. And
okay.
That is there's a quote from Dan O'Bannon about it, who was the creator and one of the screenwriters, where he talked about that. He didn't set out to do anything particularly original. What he set out to do was create the best version of the haunted house.
Sure.
And so that was kind of the approach I took to it, that I don't have to necessarily reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. I just want to tell my best version of this type of story that I can tell.
Yeah.
So for me, Alien's a huge inspiration. The Thing is a huge inspiration. Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's angles are just masterful to me. Yeah. So that kind of stuff really, really played into it. And then, you know, you start getting into things like Seven and the cinematography from that. That always left a major impression on me when we were doing this. And, you know, I kind of fell away from comics. I liked comics growing up.
Yeah.
I didn't really come back to them until I was in college.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then I didn't really see what comics could do until I read Severed by Scott Snyder.
Okay.
And that book left an impression on me. Uh-huh. And it was like, okay, it showed me that you can do comics, you can make comics scary. There is a way to do this, but it's not necessarily in the way that I feel when I watch a movie. Instead of being, you know, being a more visceral reaction, it's just kind of like a creeping feeling.
Yeah.
And that was, those were the kinds of things that really influenced me when, you know, it was time to draw this stuff.
Sure. Sure. No, it's funny that you mentioned the thing, because I don't think the house is like the, I mean, it is in the fact that there's like a military unit and they're kind of like stuck in a place, you know what I mean? But there was something about like the nature of your artwork, Drew, you know, the lines and the way that you have a style where things kind of like the lines kind of flow and kind of the lines kind of curl into each other that I noticed. And I was just like, this reminds me a little bit of The Thing. And I don't know why. Like I was just kept reading it. And I was like, there's something that's creeping me out about this book that's reminding me of The Thing. And obviously, again, I mentioned it, you know, there's a military unit and they're stuck and they don't know what they're up against. But beyond that, it was like the darkness of the pages and stuff like that. Something that you hit on those pages very much. And The Thing is one of my favorites as well. I love it. So yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just paying you a compliment there, because while I was reading it, I kept thinking The Thing, and I can't say like why, like specifically, you know, you just kind of like reach that same level of weirdness and creepiness that The Thing had to me.
Well, one, thank you. it's also, this was kind of a really intentional decision by Philip and I to you don't really have a main character in the book up until about 2/3 into it.
Yeah.
Everybody's kind of fulfilling archetypes. And that was the idea. They weren't meant to be the deepest of characters. They were meant to fulfill purpose to move the story along.
Sure.
But in doing that, they serve their purpose of creating, you know, a paranoia within a space. And, you know, that paranoia then gets smaller when you're talking about they're confined to a space and now they're confined to the group. So the circle is continually getting smaller. And I think that's part of like the brilliance of The Thing is that, you know, most people will watch that movie and go, well, it is eight people that look basically the same, not the most diverse cast, except for, you know, Keith Davidson, who, you know, anybody can pick Keith Davidson out just based on the voice.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's that idea that you always remember scenes. You don't necessarily remember character. Mm-hmm. And you always remember that, you know, that paranoia level. And that's something we kind of strove to get with the group.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you succeeded very well. I mean, I as I was reading it, like I said, I just kept going and going, and I was like, oh, this is weird. I mean, it very much reminds me of some of my favorite stuff, like The Twilight Zone or Black Mirror, like things like that, where I was just like, oh, where is this going? This feels very uncomfortable. One of the things that kind of like just came up for me while Philip was talking, I did not know that you were an artist as well. And, you know, Drew is drawing the story. How did that work with the both of you? I mean, Drew, did you ever feel any kind of like weird pressure where it was like, oh, am I doing this correctly? You know, was there any fear of like judgment from like, you know, looking at it like from through Philip's eyes, where it was like, oh, does this work correctly for him? Like, how did that sort of balance work? Because usually it's kind of like there's just a writer who only writes and can only write, you know what I mean? And then there's the artist who illustrates, and that's what they do. So how did that balance work between you since you were both artists?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll have to let Drew speak on his experience on this side, but on mine, I tried, especially when it came to the sequential pages, is what I'll say. Mm-hmm. I tried very hard to just like step back and let Drew do his magic. And oftentimes, like, I would not see the changes that he made to pacing or storytelling until I got the pages back and then went back to adjust dialogue and be like, oh, okay. Like, oh, this is a different, like, way than I had saw it, but this is actually really cool, or look how he executed this. I think the only time that I tried to be collaborative on the artistic side was when we were working on covers. And sometimes we would bounce thumbnails and layouts back and forth and kind of sketch over the previous version. And I did some inking and some coloring on some of the covers too, not all of them, but some of the final ones. But yeah, for the most part, I tried not to step into that arena and tried to just focus my brain on, like, all right, in this role, I am the writer. Because as an artist, like, I hate it when I work with collaborators who try and be like, why don't you do your job this way? Uh-huh. So I tried really hard not to, but that doesn't mean there weren't moments of collaboration when it came. Just kind of like when we were working on the outlines and the scripts, there was a lot of feedback and collaboration from Drew, but in the end, he didn't, like, rewrite everything for me to how he wanted it to see it. So I can let him speak to how he felt on that side of it.
Well, was that hard for you, though, Philip, as far as, like, pulling back and just being like, this is just my space?
I think maybe early on it was a little bit, not because of anything Drew is doing, just learning how to exist in a separate role. But it was very helpful for me as I've worked with other projects here and there. It's helped me understand, like, oh, okay, when on this project, this is the role that I'm in, and I want everyone else to do their best job, then that means that I let them do their job and what they're good at.
Sure, so, and be respectful.
It was a little bit of an adjustment first, but I think, really quickly on, it was just exciting to get work back and see how the story changed and grew and progressed and was executed.
Sure. And Drew, were you feeling any pressure, or were you just like, I'm just going to draw and this is it, like, I'm going to illustrate? I mean, Drew, did you ink the book as well? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Great job.
No, I remember we actually nicked this whole thing in the butt pretty early on.
Yeah.
So the lines were pretty clear. Phil is kind of my go-to in general when I need help with art. So It works out that way anyways, but there was never any pressure. To his credit, I was kind of free flowing and changing quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I'm sure driving him crazy when it came time to figure out lettering. and I also did this very early on to David Boer. So it's sort of a theme with me. Uh-huh. I remember the conversation basically was, you need to kind of let me do what I'm going to do, yeah, because otherwise we'll never get it done.
Yeah.
If there was an issue, if there was some major issue that needed to be addressed, or if I was stuck somewhere, Phil would absolutely step in and help out. But for the most part, I mean, he was very gracious in letting me just kind of do my thing.
Yeah.
Which, is not easy to do when you're looking at it going, well, that's not how I would do it, and you're just like, I want to do it.
Yeah.
But he did let me kind of get to it. And like I said, we had a period with the scripts where we were kind of figuring each other out in terms of the best ways to go about working with each other. But by the end of the book, I want to say, like, probably around issue 5, we were just flowing.
Sure. Sure. And so, I'm sorry, you had said, were there 7 chapters? Is that 7 different issues?
Yeah. The book is kind of the way the book is broken up in single issues is a bit of a mess.
Okay.
So originally when we came up with, so just a little context of when this book came about.
Sure.
This book came about in a very strange time for the industry.
Okay.
It came about right as the creator, the more modern day creator owned revolution was beginning, and digital was just becoming a thing. I think Comixology had just kind of come into existence.
Sure.
So the plan originally was, the book was pitched to companies, it got closed with a few of them, and then ultimately it never kind of materialized. So it was originally broken up to be set up for standard single issues.
Mm-hmm.
When it didn't materialize and we made the decision, well, we'll just we'll do it on our own. We'll do it through Comixology. I had the realization we could kind of set the page count to whatever we needed it to be.
Yeah.
And then we just kind of worked out from there. So Philip had to do a lot of rejiggering with things. So it's how you get some issues in the single issue versions that are sometimes much shorter than some of the other issues.
Oh.
And then when it came time to put the whole thing together for Kickstarter, it really does read quite well as just one graphic novel.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was one of the things that I wanted to ask about was, I mean, it flows. Like, I don't notice, like, chapter by chapter breakdowns as I'm reading it. Like, when you were pulling it together, did some stuff have to go out? Did you have to redo, like, final pages for certain chapters and redo opening pages for different chapters? Or did it just all come together neatly? Because as I was reading it, I did not notice like an endpoint, which is why I was kind of surprised that this was in, you know, broken up into issues and originally, you know, was on Comixology, like that sort of thing. So how did that work for you when you were kind of not only pulling it together for Kickstarter, but I mean, going to Dark Horse?
Yeah. So the Dark Horse edition is pretty much what the Kickstarter edition was, with the exception of just like new back matter and a new cover and the slightly different organization of information. But I think, you know,
forward by James Tinian.
Yeah. James did an awesome forward. I think when we were putting it together, singles versus trade, it was written as 9 issues pretty much. So I think through the process of writing and rewriting, we switched from single issues to trade to single issues to graphic novel. Like, we were trying to figure out the best way to approach it to also get it into market. So when we broke it up into singles, it ended up being about 9 issues, but we ended up doubling the first issue and doubling the last issue as far as size and content to try and give people something really hearty to latch onto and then a good note to end on. So it ended up 7 issues on Comixology, but the first and last issue are over/double sized. But at the same time, you know, we created and wrote it in as an entire piece. So putting it together in one solid book worked just the same as, you know, I feel like it came together very seamlessly. But I still feel like in singles, I think we managed to hit cliffhangers at every single issue. And that was always a big thing of mine, is like, if someone's going to purchase this book, this single random digital issue that is, you know, self-published essentially, I wanted them to, one, feel like they got a really engaging piece of story, mm-hmm. and two, ended in such a way that they were like, well, now I got to buy the next issue to see what happens. So it's nice that it all came together so well, but I think in production of those individual issues, I was really focused on making sure we hit really interesting points to end and begin on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so curious now to see how it broke down. Like, I'm just like, oh, wow. Like, because again, having just read it in this way, I did not notice like chapter breaks. I was just like, it just kept me going and going and going, as I, you know, read along. One of the things I'm curious about, so this started publishing it on Comixology, and the Kickstarter was just for the collected edition. Am I correct?
Correct. Yes.
So,
yes.
And how many years did it take for you? Because I mean, you know, they're indie books, they're creator owned and stuff like that. You know, these things can take a long time. How long was it from issue 1 to issue 7, like the beginning to the end for both of you?
So we started working on the book at the end of 2010. The first issue was published the beginning of 2017. So it was about 6.5 years. Uh-huh. And then I think, you know, so we did those 7 issues in roughly 9 or 10 months.
Oh, wow.
And again, considering the first issue and last issue was double sized, and because I think the 7th issue came out in October 2017. So it was published fairly regularly, but I spent about 3 years writing it off and on, and then Drew spent about 3 years drawing it. So
There was a period that the entire front half of the book, I think I started it, and then another project came up that I had to go and do. And by the time I came back to this, it just wasn't up to snuff, and we ended up starting it over. So I think I've actually got one of the pages of the reveal of the house. Phillip's got the original page, double page spread from the book, but I have the original version that I did before we decided to go back and, you know, just kind of start it over.
Yeah. No, that's funny, because one of the things I mentioned is, like, I have this little comic I do as a hobby, and it's taken me years and years and years just, you know, to go. And then it's like I'm finally sort of getting to the second chapter of it. And I look back at and I'm like, I want to redo that whole thing. And my wife is like, you're not redoing the whole thing. You're not. She's like, things change. She's like, look at Peanuts when it first started and look at it now. You know what I mean? She's just like, you're not doing that. That's so funny to me. But it's great that, you know, you were able to go back and, you know, you do it the way that you want it, I should say.
I've had to act as the role of your wife in relationship.
Yeah, that's very, like, on numerous occasions.
Like, wants to start the whole thing over again. I was like, no, we've been working on this for a decade. Just let it go.
Just let it go. That's great. Yeah, which is very hard, I'm sure, as both of you know, is for artists to do and just be like, no. But my question is to the timing of everything is, again, the thing that I've mentioned that I love about this book is the pacing, right? Like that it keeps going and you're into it and you're moving along and along and along. How hard was it to maintain that pacing in this book as you're working on it, you know, through the years? Because, and then how hard was it to maintain enthusiasm for it, right? Because I'm sure that as artists and writers and whatever, you know, things take a long time, and I'm sure you go through ups and downs of just being like, ugh, do I want to do this right now? Like, you know what I mean? So can you speak to me about a little bit about that? Because I mean, that's one of the things that indie creators have to struggle with, is being able to make their books when they can and do it when they have time, and then just maintaining the breakneck pace of like what you were doing. Because to me, it reads, again, no chapter breaks. Like I was just like, pa, 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 like going through it. So maintaining that energy and maintaining that pace. Can you speak to that, please?
Yeah, I think one of the things that Drew and I have repeatedly said about this, and we feel very strongly, is like, this book exists through sheer force of will. It was a book we decided we wanted to do. We worked really hard. We had a couple close calls with publishers, and it just felt like it wasn't going to happen. And then finally we realized, like, we don't need anyone's permission to do this book. We're just going to do this damn book. Because we were too hard-headed to get the message, we made the book happen. And I think it was that sheer force of will combined with, you know, seeing it come together as we went along. Like, we financed the production of the book. We paid for colors. We paid for letters. It took us till, I think, just before Dark Horse, you know, picked the book up before we finally recouped our investment. So it was like 10 years of work before we, you know, we broke even. And it was going to happen because we wanted it to happen. And any success we've had of the book and being able to see it digitally and then Kickstarter and now copies of the Dark Horse book, like, none of those would exist if we didn't decide to do it and then put the blood, sweat, and tears for over a decade into the book to make it actually happen.
Yeah. 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 But I mean, sort of maintaining the pace, Drew, how did that work for you as far as, like, you know, panel breakdowns and stuff going back and forth?
You mean just like over the years coming up with this, or?
Yeah. I mean, just over the years working on it. Right. Because I mean, like when you finally, you know, I mean, you must've had to stop and start, correct?
Yeah. So the way this really kind of came about for me was, the book I went to do, you know, that kind of stopped production on this was Skybreaker with, Mike Morisi.
Uh-huh.
And I was really proud of that book, and I thought that was going to kind of kickstart my career and get the house going. I mean, I've always believed in this idea.
Sure.
This story and, you know, everything that Philip and I crafted with it. When Skybreaker came out, though, it, you know, it did well critically, mm-hmm. and it didn't do anything for my career.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, you know, I felt like I was kind of saddled back to square one, and I had just finished reading Lock and Key, and I remember sitting there thinking, I want to tell stories like this at this level. And I looked down and remember, well, I have the house. Yeah. And this is still something that we're now like 2 years or maybe 3 years into it. And I'm like, I still love this idea as much as I did when we started it. And now I've got 5 issues of a full project and getting better with my skills under my belt.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have been able to do the house without having had done Skybreaker first. But, you know, believing in the project and seeing it come together and realizing, oh, we can actually do this and produce it at the level that I think both of us wanted to see it. That was a big motivating factor. That and the fact that, you know, no one's gonna give it to you.
Yeah.
I've always been a believer that the best thing you can do for yourself is build for yourself. And, you know, invest in yourself. And the house is very much that. And that mindset, you know, is carried me over to Canto. It's carried Philip into his other projects. You know, there just is there's a lot to be said for just going out there, doing it on your own and putting the time and effort into it to make it as good as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. Well, you both very much succeeded, in my opinion. I guess one of the things we haven't really chatted about, I mean, I mentioned what the house was, you know, kind of like World War II soldiers in a haunted house. But I haven't asked you, like, what was the elevator pitch for the house? Like, how did you present it to people? What do people need to know about the house?
Sure, that's a great question. The elevator pitch that we give on the book is it's a squadron of U.S. soldiers in World War II during the Battle of the Bulge get lost in the woods, and as a whiteout blizzard starts to roll in, they seek refuge from the storm, and they stumble across an abandoned manor house in the middle of the woods. So they go inside to be safe during this storm, but once they're inside, the doors disappear.
Yeah.
And they have to figure out how to get out, and all sorts of shenanigans ensue.
Yeah, I mean, that was one.
Pitch was Band of Brothers meets the Amityville Horror.
Oh, nice, nice, nice. I was going to say, Band of Brothers meets maybe like Evil Dead or something like that. Like I was like, this is very cool. I mean, when I was reading it, I mean, there's also other elements of it too, right? Maybe this is kind of what reminded me of The Thing, is that you sort of insinuate that this evil that's in the house has been around for a very, very long time, correct?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. But there's no like answers to that, correct?
Yeah, no, we like posing the questions, we like teasing out information, but also the best horror doesn't give you all the answers. It lets you build a story in your mind, and that's kind of where we landed on it.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, it was great because, I mean, that was one of the things that reminded me of The Thing, because it seems like there's a panel in there with, like, dinosaurs, and I was just like, wow, this thing's been around a long time. Did I misread that panel, or is that...
No, I don't think so.
That's correct. the idea was, you know, we knew the story we were telling was very contained.
Sure.
The challenge then becomes, how do you build lore around this very confined story?
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuff was the idea of how to do it. And it wasn't meant to be explicit for the reader. It's meant to just infer it. And for them to kind of draw their own conclusions.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, well, one of the things I mean, obviously this takes place World War II. This is kind of like in, you know, Germany, correct? People are speaking German. I had to break out my, I did not do this while I read the book, but at the end of the book, I broke out Google Translate and was like starting to type. I'm like, what did this guy say? What did this person say? But there is a sort of thing towards the end where the whole, well, I mean, it's not like a ton of dialogue, but all of it is in German, right? And it kind of reminded me of like, what was that Netflix show that just came, that it was, it's called Dark, and it was in German.
Dark is the best thing Netflix has
done. Yeah, I know. I was like, I was reading that last page and I was like, oh, now this reminds me of Dark, you know, where it's like, there's this weird, yeah. I mean, Dark is about like, it's funny because one of the first things, you know, they go into this house and I felt like, you know, being a nerd of all things, right? Like I love horror, I love sci-fi and stuff like that. I was like, oh, they just stepped into a TARDIS, right? Like the house is bigger on the inside, you know, like, I mean, did Doctor Who lose his TARDIS? Yeah. And then at the end, it's like, it's all in German and there's a scene in the woods and I don't want to ruin what it is, but it very much reminded, you know, part of Dark is these kids discovering this tunnel that takes them into different eras of time, right? And yeah. I just saw that all that stuff was great. I mean, it works terrifically, but can you speak to me about, well, maybe not why it's set in Germany, but, you know, like leaving that chapter at the end, like all in German, and does the house move? Does it stay in Germany? I guess, you know, you don't have to answer that. You could just be like, we'll find out in the next chapter. But yeah, can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to speak to those final couple of pages without kind of spoiling the climax.
Sure.
Because it very much ties into where the book ends and just kind of a fun little tease about potentially, you know, the expanse of time between the ending and the little couple page epilogue there at the end before we get into kind of our last little bit. So yeah, it was fun. Like, yeah, I had some help from some friends who speak German and to get translation right. But
nice.
I enjoy books that force you to pay a little bit more attention. So instead of doing like the, you know, in brackets translated from German or whatever, yeah, yeah. I just left it. We left the language as it was. And if someone wants to translate it, they can. But I think between what's happening and Drew's art, you can kind of infer what their conversation is and kind of where that goes from there.
Yeah. Or use Google Translate like I did.
Or use Google Translate. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, I did not do that while I was reading it, but I was like, okay, now I'm going to go back and I need to know what those people said. So I was just like typing everything into Google Translate. I mean, you both did a great job as sort of, because what's interesting to me, or at least it seems like, is that the house is not always like a house, right? Like in the beginning, it's kind of like a cabin in like the chapter that I said, like in the Pilgrim times or whatever. And then, you know, this World War II, takes place in sort of like an old kind of like Gothic mansion. And then mm-hmm. later on, it's something else. It just seems like an evil that has, or a presence that has just been, you know, disguising itself in the period that it exists. Am I making sense there?
Yeah. Yeah. From the beginning with those things, we do tease that it's a presence that's been around since kind of the beginning. And then what people do with it or how it affects them is very different from person to person. And that kind of gets into some of the lore that we explore a little bit in the book.
That's great. So are there plans for, are you planning on doing a sequel? Are you planning on, you know, expanding the house, like putting an add-on maybe, you know, to the house, you know, going further, or has this project taken up so much of your time that you're just like, okay, I'm just going to leave the house there and, you know, let it settle, that sort of thing.
You know, I feel that we've talked about what we could do from here. I mean, as far as like house to the second story or something like I feel like we have told the stories we can with this haunted house thing. We pulled out all the stops. We went as big as we could. But that doesn't mean we wouldn't want to tell more stories that are
based in kind of this universe. We've talked about kind of spiritual sequels to the book and would love to at some point get back to exploring different horror concepts set around different conflicts and war and periods of time. But not necessarily doing like, you know, oh, now the house popped up in Japan during feudal times. And sure. I mean, not like that wouldn't be cool, but at the same time, like, you know, I don't want to go back to the same bag of tricks constantly. Right. So.
I have an idea of how to do a second one. It's something that I haven't, you know, workshopped out yet. But, you know, our big thing is that we have a story that's worth telling. And, you know, like Philip said, we really used every trick we had in the bag for this, because our feeling was it's either go big or go home. Who knows if we're ever going to get to do this stuff again. So let's use everything we've got to serve the story.
Sure.
I think the idea of going back to a haunted house is a tricky one for us, especially for six issues of it. But, you know, we definitely have other ideas that are kind of set in universe but aren't necessarily sequels for this.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So one of the things I wanted to ask, you know, and before we sign off, because we're almost at an hour and, you know, I don't want to take up too much of your time. Time is precious as creators, and I appreciate you spending your time with me right now. But what are sort of your ideas about haunted houses and ghosts? Because, you know, a lot of people have different things. And while I was reading this book, I was thinking, oh, you know, because there's the idea of like, oh, ghosts are like people left behind who never finished, you know, business or, you know, were killed and the mystery was never solved or that sort of thing, or survived trauma. And then there's the idea of like that haunted house is like a bit of like a traumatic memory, like trapped in time, you know what I'm saying? But two of my favorite horror movies are The Haunting and The Innocents. And, you know, having read ghost stories and stuff like that, for me, it seems like ghosts are the things that I don't know that what they're there purposely for, but they are there to drive you slowly insane. Like, they can't do any harm to you, but the idea of the supernatural and the crazy things that sneak up on you and the tension that builds, like all of that is to sort of like drive you so nuts that you do harm to yourself. But reading this book, I just was curious about what are some of your ideas as far as hauntings, as far as haunted houses, ghosts, and do you think any of that stuff is real?
Okay, so you're asking kind of like personal philosophy?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as far as like ghosts and maybe how you approached it for this book.
Yeah, I mean, for this book, I think a lot of what the house does and how it affects people and what it brings out plays out in the story, as far as, you know, that kind of, you know, what you bring in is what you see type stuff. And I won't expand on that, so I don't spoil anything for the people who read it.
Sure.
I remember as I was writing it, I hit a point after what felt like far too long. and I reached out to Drew and I was like, oh, it's not X, it's Y. That's why this is happening. And Drew was like, yeah, duh. Like, that was the whole point. And I was like, oh, I don't know how I didn't catch on. Like, you know, it was just, I guess I had to explore it as a writer for a while until I kind of latched on to the concept and what makes this book different than kind of other stuff.
Sure.
I mean, and as far as personal philosophies, I don't know if I really have an opinion one way or the other on ghosts and supernatural phenomenon. I'm not, you know, on a personal level, I don't know how much of that stuff I believe, but at the same time, I like unknown. I like leaving room open for like whatever reality and life brings at you. And I'm not as concerned about trying to understand everything. I don't know, Drew, how about you?
It's something I kind of go back and forth on. So, you know, my day job is that, you know, I'm an EMT in New York City.
Oh, wow.
I have been present and pronounced myself dozens of people. I've been the one that's gone, you know, time of death, and, you know, then leave them in their apartment for the cops and the ME to come and get.
Yeah.
You know, have I ever seen a ghost? No. Do I kind of subscribe to the belief that a ghost isn't necessarily real as much as, you know, lingering feelings are real. I think humans have a tendency to create their own ghost out of their guilt or whatever other personal issues they've got. Mm-hmm. And I've definitely been in areas that are creepy, especially in New York City, where, you know, the place has been around for forever. Yeah. And there have been more than their fair share of horrible things that have happened here. But, you know, as far as physical ghosts, it's not something I've ever seen, but I'm not like closed off to the idea that it exists. I just think it's more about, you know, feelings that you get or just being uncomfortable with areas. For me personally, I have a hard time down at Ground Zero. I find the whole place to just be super uncomfortable to be around.
Yeah.
Does that mean there are ghosts down there? Not in the traditional sense of ghosts, but there's definitely everybody's, you know, baggage floating around.
Understood. Yeah. Well, I don't necessarily believe in ghosts myself, but I do believe in the house. See what I did there? I think this is a great book. I appreciate Melissa, your PR agent. Melissa, I'm gonna massacre her name. Mazaros, is that her last name? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's it.
Got it. Okay, Melissa Mazaros, for putting me in touch with you. She's great. I love her. Well, she's fantastic. I mean, maybe love is too strong a word. Sorry, that's inappropriate.
I love Melissa. Okay. She is the best investment I ever made in this industry was getting somebody who is better at PR than me.
Well, what I meant to say is she's great. Never met her in person, but I thank her for putting me into contact with the both of you. I love your book. It comes out, it's already out or it's coming out this week from Dark Horse?
So it came out last week in comic book stores, and I believe it's either this week or the coming week it'll be available like on Amazon. So
gotcha. Well, definitely check out The House from Dark Horse Comics. I have had Philip Seavey and Drew Zucker on the line. Again, the book is called The House. Thank you so much for joining me, gentlemen. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. We very much appreciate it.
Yep. And
thanks
you,
for having us. This has been great.
Well, oh, great. Good. Well, you're welcome to come back anytime for whatever project you may have. This has been a really nice chat for a really great book. If you love horror, do yourself a favor. Check out The House. I very much enjoyed it. It's definitely something that, as a horror fan, I'm glad that I've read. And check out The House, Dark Horse Comics. My name is Christian Horn. This has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening. Check out The House, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm doing part-time.
Part-time fanboy.